suit, smiled, and asked, "Can we help you?" "I'm looking for autumn and winter suits. I was told to ask for Ted." Ted was a thin man, older and balding, with a shy smile and a soft voice. Lucas introduced himself, and Ted said, "Oh, yes, the gentleman from Minnesota." After that, it was 45 minutes of looking at fabrics and talking about colors, not only of the materials, but of Lucas's eyes, hair, and complexion. There was also a subtle interview about where Lucas had bought other suits, accessories, and shoes. Next came 40 minutes of measurements, after which Ted said, "This should be good enough for the preliminary work. You will have to come in again for the next fitting, probably in 2 or 3 weeks." "That'll be fine," Lucas said. "I'd like to get them before it gets cold back home." "We should have them finished by mid-September." Lucas spent an absurd sum on the suits, put it all on his American Express card. When it had cleared, Ted called a taxi, and Lucas shook his hand and said, "This was a nice experience." "Happy to be of help," Ted said as he walked Lucas to the door. "There aren't that many men who take your interest. Mostly they want something dark that won't wrinkle too badly, and they want it quick." Lucas smiled, went out the door, heard the lock click behind him, and walked down the stoop to the street, where the pleasant evening came to an end. 3 men. At a casual glance, they might have been street people, funky dress, too heavy for the heat, with weird headgear. But the funky dress was too clean and too uniformly funky, as though it had been manufactured that way. None of them had beards. And they didn't move with the halting gait of longtime street people. They moved like well-fed athletes. They were coming in hard, and they weren't carrying anything in their hands. In addition, there were a few more salient aspects to the approach. One, the jackets looked heavy, as though they might be covering armored vests, which would be good protection in a fistfight. Two, they were all wearing hats pulled low on their heads. One wore a ball cap, and the other two wore tennis hats. Tennis hats on bums? Don't think so. Three, Lucas could feel them focus on him. One was hurrying in from his left, one was crossing the street straight toward him, one was coming in from his right. No gun. Couldn't get back inside, the door had locked behind him. In the 2 seconds that it took him to scan the three of them and discern their intention, he made a snap decision. Run. The guy on the right was the bulkiest and maybe the slowest, and Lucas ran right for him, then swerved to the right, and when the guy moved to block him, Lucas cut left. The guy swung at him. Lucas blocked his fist, and with the heel of the same hand, hit the man in the face under the nose, jamming it up into the ridge of his brow, sending him staggering and down on his back. As Lucas hit him, he realized he couldn't see the man's mouth. He was wearing a tan-knit face mask. The impact turned Lucas enough that he could see the other two were almost on top of him. He pivoted and went left, which meant that the farthest one would be behind the closer one, and Lucas would only have to fend off one man. The closer one pulled a flashlight from his pocket as he came in, a mag light, as good as a billy club. Lucas dodged him, but then was open to both of them again, and he turned away, and the man with the flashlight swung it at him, hit him in the back below his left shoulder, above his shoulder blade, and he stumbled and half-turned and nearly stumbled over the first man, who was back on his hands and knees. Lucas cleared him, and the flashlight man came in again, and Lucas dodged the light and grabbed the man's face mask and wrenched it sideways, enough to see the man's face for an instant, from the eyes down. The man wrenched free, and the mask slipped up over his eyes and blinded him. He collided with the third man, and they reeled away. Lucas took advantage of the break to jump over the man on the ground, digging a heel into his back in the process, and Lucas was off and running. Lucas had a step on them, probably not enough. Then there was a burst of light and another, and Lucas thought maybe he'd been shot at, but there was no sound, and the lightning flash came from across the street rather than from behind him. He glanced that direction and saw a tall, thin Asian man holding a cell phone and a briefcase, and it registered in the back of Lucas's brain that the Asian man had taken a cell phone photo of the fight. The flash also diverted the attackers. One of them took several running steps toward the Asian man, but another of the men shouted, "No, no, no!" as the Asian man turned and sprinted down the street. Lucas followed, slower than he might have if he hadn't worn dress shoes to buy a suit, and Lucas began screaming, "Help! Help! Help!" He was loud and moving fast, and though there were few people on the street, heads were turning their way. Lucas continued running for another 100 feet before risking another glance back and saw the three men running in the opposite direction before disappearing down a cross street. The Asian man had stopped ahead, and Lucas ran toward him and called out, "U.S. Marshal, wait, wait!" The man slowed, and Lucas got his ID from his jacket pocket and held it in front of him. Gasping for air, he stuttered, I'm a U.S. Marshal. Did you take a photo of that fight?" The Asian man nodded and said in perfect English, "Yes, two pictures. Who were those men?" "I don't know," Lucas said. "Maybe muggers." "I don't think so," the Asian man said. "They all wear masks. They all look the same. I don't think muggers." Lucas nodded. "Could you please send those photos to my phone?" "Yes, I will, of course." The photos came in. They were sharp enough, but all you could read from them were shapes and sizes. Lucas got the man's name and address in Japan. He was staying at a Washington hotel, on a business trip. As Lucas shook the man's hand, a cab came around the corner. Lucas jumped in front of it, and the driver ran his window down and said, "I've got a call," and Lucas said, "If it's Figueroa and Prince, it's me." He was still breathing hard and sweating, and the driver looked at him doubtfully. He said, "Well, okay, that's where I was going." Lucas got in the back and said, "Watergate Hotel." The driver pulled away, saying, "I could be wrong, but in my opinion, it's too goddamn hot to jog in a suit and tie." "Gotta get your cardio where you can," Lucas said. They passed the spot where he'd last seen the trio of men, but they were gone. He wouldn't be going out again without a gun, but even if he'd had one, he didn't know if he could have gotten it out in time. The three men had been closing fast and looked competent and maybe were armed. If he'd pulled a gun, they might have shot him. Still, he was embarrassed. He'd had to run, and he'd been screaming for help like a little girl. "So how about them nationals?" the driver asked. "I'm from Minnesota," Lucas said, sinking back in the seat. "I'm a Twins fan." The driver thought for a few seconds and said, "Then I got nothing." At the hotel, he checked the recorder. Nobody had been in the room as far as he could tell, and he called Ray. "How soon can you and Bob get here?" she said. "Uh-oh," Lucas said. "Yeah." When he got off the phone, he was still high on adrenaline. He eventually put on some gym shorts, a T-shirt, and athletic shoes, went down to the fitness center, and ran off the high on the elliptical machine. Back in his room, he showered, concentrating on his back. He'd have a major bruise where the maglite hit, he thought. Out of the shower, he watched the end of a Dodgers game from the West Coast, flopped on the bed, and thought about getting old. He'd barely cracked 50. But he had lost at least a step in the past 10 years, and maybe 2 steps. The three muggers would have beaten the shit out of him. He spent some time brooding, and finally managed to get to sleep at 2 in the morning. He'd gotten up the next morning, had shaved, showered, and was about to go to breakfast when Fort called and said, "You're not fucking around with this Heracles place, are you?" 8. Fort said, "These are bad guys, Lucas. Mercenaries. There have been a dozen complaints filed against them by military people in Iraq and Syria, and more by the Iraqi and Libyan governments. They shoot first and ask questions later, but it appears that we continue to contract with them. By we, I mean the Defense Department and contractors working with foreign governments. Can't tell about the CIA, but probably there, too. Do they work here in the U.S.? They've got no special status here," Fort said. "They poke a gun at somebody, and that's ag assault, and they go to jail. They're not Leos, not law enforcement officers, no way, shape, or form. If they jumped me on the street, did they do that?" "Somebody did," Lucas said. He told Fort about the problem he'd had the night before and described the three men. He left out the part about screaming for help like a little girl. "Well, there you go," Fort said. "It sounds like what I imagine the Heracles guys are like, though I've never actually seen them myself. Most of what they call action executives are former SEALs, Delta, Force Recon, Rangers, that sort of thing. You didn't see a gun?" "No." All three were wearing jackets that had some bulk, like they were wearing light armor or maybe thick shirts or padding of some kind, like they were ready for a fight, Lucas said. "I suspect they were planning to take me down, but not kill me. Killing me would cause somebody a much larger problem than what might pass as the mugging of an out-of-towner." "You're sure that's not what it was?" Fort asked. "Yeah, I'm sure. They were all too neat. Uniform. They wore masks. They didn't look like raggedy-ass muggers. They looked like cops, actually." "Here's what I want you to do," Fort said. "Write it up, all the details. Put those cell phone photos with it. I'll file it as attack on a U.S. Marshal, unsolved. Then, if you identify one of the guys, we grab him, file charges. With you as the only witness, we might not get far with it, but we might be able to squeeze the guy while we've got him. Probably should have done that last night, or called the D.C. cops. I'll call the cops, inform them. I can somewhat mask the time of your report. If they think you reported it immediately, well, let them think that. That way we're on record with two different agencies. All right. So, sounds like life is getting complicated. But that's why you were hired," Fort said. "What else are you going to do about it?" "Call Bob and Ray, for one thing. They'll be talking to you guys about coming up here. We'll clear them through. Now, about that Ford F-250. There are 47 black F-250 short beds of last year's model registered in the three zip codes surrounding the area where those plates were stolen. Black is a popular color. But the F-250 is pricey, so there weren't as many as I expected." Lucas. "The West Virginia cop I talked to, Armstrong, yeah, he said the truck was new, but didn't specify a year, so maybe we should look at this year's, too." "Nope. I talked to him this morning, soon as I got in, and he sent me some grab shots from the security video," Fort said. "The taillights changed between the 2 years. It was last year's model, not this year's." "Did you get the driver's licenses and run them?" "I did. Got a whole bunch of hits, but nothing that went directly to Heracles. Several military people, more Navy than Army, but that could include SEALs. Criminal activity is all minor stuff. A few drunk driving arrests, domestics, like that." "Can you get me the license photos?" Lucas asked. "We're queuing them up now, my assistant is. You'll have them in 20 minutes. "Russell, thank you. I'll keep you up to date." "Stay safe," Fort said. "I don't like the sound of that thing from last night." Lucas took the elevator down, ate breakfast, took the elevator back up, and found 47 driver's license photos attached to an email. 12 were women, which, if not irrelevant, wouldn't match any of the faces either he or the hotel security man had seen. He flipped through the 47, returning a couple of times to the image of a James Harold Ritter, age 39. He resembled the man whose mask he'd pulled down. He'd been wearing a green tennis hat low on his forehead, so Lucas wasn't positive about the ID, but the chin and mouth looked right. He got on the phone and called Schneider, the hotel security chief, and asked if Jeff Toombs was on duty. Toombs had seen the man he thought might have come from Lucas's hotel room. Toombs was in the hotel, and Schneider said he'd send him up. He arrived 10 minutes later, smelling faintly of onion rings. Lucas let him in, sat him at the desk in front of Lucas's laptop, and let him scan the photos. "I don't think so," he said eventually. "Photos aren't so great, but none of them ring a bell." As Lucas took him to the door, Toombs turned and said, "Let me show you something." He swerved into the bathroom where a box of facial tissue sat on the sink counter. He pulled out a sheet, tore off a quarter-sized piece, dropped the rest of it in the toilet, touched the small piece to the tip of his tongue, wetting it, wadded it into a small spitball, and pressed it into the peephole of the door. "These peepholes work both ways," he said. "There was this freak who'd go around making movies of famous women who were walking around their room naked. He was shooting through the peephole. I'm told that you can buy special lenses for that specific purpose on the Internet. Unless you want to take the chance that somebody's looking at you, keep the spitball in it." "I'll do that," Lucas said. "You're good at this hotel security stuff, huh?" "Yeah, I am," Toombs said. "A lot of weird shit happens in hotels. It's interesting." When he was gone, Lucas called Fort. "I need everything you can find on James Harold Ritter. You've got his license info, so that's a good start. Nothing's too small." "I'm in a meeting. Give me a couple of hours." "Fine. I'm going to go scout his house, see what I can see," Lucas said. "Easy, boy." He did not leave immediately. Instead, he called Smalls and said, "You've got a woman working for you at the cabin, Janet Walker." "Yes. She runs a caretaking service for absentee landowners." "I need her phone number," Lucas said. Smalls went away for a while, then came back for the number. "Her cell phone. She usually answers right away." She did. Lucas identified himself and asked, "Do you have access to the Internet?" She said, "I live in West Virginia, not on the friggin' moon." "Great. Do you have it handy?" "I'm in the yard. I'd have to walk into the house." "I'm going to send you 8 or 10 photographs. Tell me if any of them look like the guys you saw driving the F-250. The whole round trip with the photographs took 5 minutes. Lucas sent 10, and after examining them, Walker said, "The third photograph, that looks like the driver. I'm not sure I could swear it was him if it went to court, but it looks like him." "Thank you," Lucas said. "Keep this under your hat, if you would." James Harold Ritter. Lucas had 3 markers pointing at Ritter. His impression of the attacker's face on the street, Walker's identification, and the fact that he owned a black F-250. Could be a coincidence with a little bit of a stretch, but Lucas felt he was on a roll, that Ritter was the one. Like most of the other people Lucas was trying to find, Ritter lived across the Potomac in Virginia, in what turned out to be a neatly kept condominium complex not far from where the F-250 plates had been stolen. The complex had individual covered parking spaces at the back of the building. Although Ritter's driver's license hadn't included an apartment number, Lucas spotted the black Ford pickup, which did have an associated apartment number. The apartment number apparently included a vacant space beside the pickup. Lucas parked in a visitor's lot and walked back to the F-250. There was nobody around in the noon heat, so he walked into the covered parking area and took a close look at the truck. Smalls had said that his Cadillac had been hit by the passenger side of the attacker's vehicle, and when Lucas squatted at the back of the truck bed, he thought he could see a subtle distortion in the truck's sheet metal. He checked the driver's side for a comparison, and when he came back to the passenger side, the distortion, nothing as clear-cut as a dent or a tear, seemed even more apparent, like a quarter-inch wave in the flow of the metal. He walked down the side of the truck to look at it from the front. The same distortion was visible, and the front right headlight cover had a small crack on the right side. He peered in the passenger side window, but there was nothing visible on the seats. He pulled out a shirt tail, used it to cover his hand as he tried all four doors. All four were locked. The truck had been recently washed, Lucas thought, dragging his shirt-tail-covered hand across it. It was virtually spotless, and even a heavy forensic examination might have trouble placing it in West Virginia. Still, the truck had been involved in an unusual impact. He wasn't sure he'd found the truck that had taken Smalls and Whitehead off the road, but he'd found a solid candidate. Proving it would be another problem, a greater problem than simply knowing it. But what kind of impact would leave both trucks without obvious damage while still being violent enough to knock one truck right off the road? He thought about it. His first thought. What if Ritter and his friends had rigged a lattice of freshly cut tree trunks and hung it off the side of their truck? They would have had to put padding under the trunks against the side of the truck to prevent damage, but they'd want the raw timber to hit the Cadillac. It'd be simple enough. When Lucas was in the Boy Scouts, his troop had built rafts out of dead wood and rope and had floated down the Rum River on them. Hung on the side of a truck, the rafts would have worked well as protection against impact and, even better, would have left evidence of wood contacting metal. But who would think of that? People who thought about killing other people in undetectable ways, Lucas figured. Professionals who were given a problem. Knock a car off the road and down a bluff without any metal-on-metal contact. Given that dilemma, the tree trunk lattice idea would pop right up. Lucas walked back to the Evoque, cranked it up, pushed the air conditioner to max, and called Carl Armstrong, the West Virginia accident investigator. "I may have found that F-250," he said when Armstrong was on the phone. He described the truck's condition and asked, "Since you can see there was some impact, but since it's been washed, is there going to be anything there for you?" "If we can show there's been an impact, we could question him about when it happened and why it is that the damage was both extensive yet subtle, and whether he reported the accident. That kind of damage would be uncommon. In fact, I've never run into anything like it. Be hard to explain." Lucas told Armstrong about the tree trunk lattice idea, and after a moment Armstrong said, "That seems kinda unlikely, not to say stupid." "I've given you an explanation," Lucas said. "Do you think my idea could result in the kind of damage I've seen?" "Well," Lucas could visualize Armstrong scratching his head, "it could, I guess, if it was padded on the backside. Maybe something like a good solid rubber mat, that would do it. As far as finding hard forensic evidence, sounds unlikely. For one thing, everything you find driving around eastern West Virginia, you'll find driving around Virginia, pollen and all that." "Okay, I don't want to do anything with it now, but I may be calling you to take a professional look after we're out in the open on the investigation." "Happy to do it," Armstrong said. "But really, a lattice?" Lucas walked around to the front of the condominium complex and went to the glass front door, which turned out to be the first of two doors. He could get inside the outside glass one, but the interior door was locked. There was a phone on the wall with a sign that boldly said, "Dial 1 plus apartment number," and below that, not so boldly, "Dial 1 plus 00 for management office." A domed security camera in the ceiling monitored the door and the phone. He called the office, identified himself to the woman who answered.
"I'll buzz you in. Take the first left and walk all the way down the hall to the end, where the last door on the left."
She buzzed him in. Inside the door was an enclosed booth for mail, with mailboxes on the outside for the residents and an enclosed area behind them that would allow the mail carrier to insert mail in the open backs of the boxes without needing keys to open them. No camera was monitoring the booth's door. Lucas tested the door. Locked, but the lock was crappy and the door rattled in its frame. He continued on into the building, took the first left, walked down to the end of the hall and into the office, where a woman sat at a desk behind a service counter. She looked up from her computer and asked, "What's going on?" Lucas flashed his ID and badge at her, said, "I'm a U.S. Marshal. We are trying to talk to Thomas D. Pope, who we understand lives here." She looked puzzled and said,
"I know everybody who lives here. There's no Thomas Pope."
Lucas said, "Huh? Are you sure?"
"Absolutely positive," she said. "Are you sure you got the name right?"
Lucas scratched his head. "I got the name right, but I might have the wrong apartment building. I'm navigating with a description and don't have an exact address as such."
"You need an address," the woman said. "There are about 1 million apartment buildings around here. This is a nice one, but there are quite a few that look like it."
Lucas rubbed his nose. "Well, shoot, I guess I'm going to have to do it the hard way. Getting an exact address is a little harder than it usually would be, since the guy moves around a lot."
"I wish I could help you."
"Well, not your fault. Have a good day." Lucas walked back toward the main entrance, but instead of going out, he passed the elevators and then took a staircase up to the second floor. Hallways stretched in both directions from the landing, burgundy carpet in one direction, blue in the other. Nobody was in the hallway. The complex was white-collar, and residents were at work. If he needed to blackbag Ritter's apartment, there wouldn't be a lot of people around, and he saw no security cameras. He went back down the stairs, headed toward the exit. At the mail booth, he checked for movement inside and out, grabbed the doorknob, and put all of his weight against the door, pushing it sideways toward the door hinges, and with an additional punch from the shoulder, the door popped open. He looked around again, stepped into the booth. The backs of the mailboxes were all identified by name and apartment number. Lucas scanned them, found Ritter's. A half dozen pieces of mail sat inside it, and he quickly thumbed through them while listening for footsteps. 3 ads, an electric bill, and a bank statement. He stuck the bank statement in his jacket pocket, replaced the rest of the mail. The lock on the door had a turn bolt on the inside, and he unlocked it, stepped outside, and pushed the door shut behind him. Maybe the mail carrier would think he'd forgotten to lock it. He walked outside, let the stress fall away in the sunshine. Mail theft. A federal felony if anybody found out about it, but nobody would. He hoped. He walked back around the building. The heat was stifling, and though he had only been out of the Evoque for a few minutes, the interior was already intolerably hot. He started the truck, stood outside briefly, peeling off his jacket while the air conditioner took hold, got back in, and opened Ritter's bank statement. The statement listed routine payments to 15 or 20 different places. Gas, electric, water, cable, Visa, Amex. The incoming money was more interesting. He found what appeared to be weekly paychecks from a company called Flamma Consultants. He stuck the letter in his hip pocket. He'd shred it and flush it down the toilet back at the hotel. As he was headed back across the Potomac, he took a call from Ray Givens.
"We talked to your man Fort, and we're on our way down to New Orleans right now. We'll be flying back straight into D.C. He got us rooms at the Watergate Hotel." I said, "Are you kidding?" And he said, "No, why would I be?" I said, "Okay. So we'll see you there tonight."
A second call came from Fort himself with information about Ritter.
"There's not much on him in the files. We're not allowed to see his income tax returns, but we did take a look at his army records and his passport. He did 3 tours in Iraq, got good evaluations, landed a job with Delta, and looked like he was in there for life. Instead of reenlisting a 3rd time, he dropped out. His passport would suggest he's been out of the country, in Iraq, Kuwait, Afghanistan, and Pakistan for most of the time since then."
A guy who knows his way around. A hard guy.
"Yes. Did you get anything?"
"I did. I'll tell you, Russell, I'm going back to the hotel to write this up, but basically, Smalls's accident was no accident. It was an assassination attempt and a murder, and Ritter was in it up to his neck. His truck was used to run Smalls and Whitehead off the road."
"Lucas, you gotta be sure," Fort said. "It's too hot to be wrong."
"I am sure now, but I can't prove it yet. Between us, we have to figure out where to go with this. Think about it.
Write it all up in detail. Don't leave a single fucking thing out of it. If they smell you coming for them, they might not try to beat you up again, and next time they might come with guns. Bob and Ray are a good idea, but might not be enough. I need to know everything you get in case you have a problem."
Like getting shot, Lucas thought, smiling to himself.
"I'll send you an email, Russell, later this afternoon."
At the hotel, Lucas made a few notes, then shredded Ritter's bank statement and flushed it. That done, he kicked off his shoes, dropped onto the bed, and used his burner phone to call a St. Paul friend named Kidd, a painter and an expert in computer databases. Kidd's wife, Lucas believed, was a jewel thief, but that was another story. Kidd came up, and Lucas identified himself.
"Uh-oh, using a burner?"
And asked Kidd what his favorite charity was.
"Other than myself, the Minneapolis Institute of Art. Weather's a big deal over there, I understand," Kidd said.
"I will give $1,000 to the Institute if you can dig up some stuff on the Internet and tell me how I could have done it myself," Lucas said.
"What's it all about that you have to use a burner to even ask me the question?"
"It's about a murder and an assassination attempt." Kidd had helped Lucas with the original investigation of Taron Grant. Like Lucas, he believed that Grant was a murderer and that she had gotten to the Senate through a murderous political trick. Lucas explained about the accident and what he'd found about Ritter and told him about Jack Parrish and Heracles.
I would have a hard time explaining how I came up with the connection between Ritter and Flamma," Lucas said. "I need to be able to make the connection on the net. You know, like I did some research and there it was. I need it quick."
Kidd said he'd start looking.
"I'd like to see you get Grant. She's your basic fascist thug, but with great tits," he said.
From the background, Lucas heard Kidd's wife, Lauren, shout,
"Hey, I'm standing right here."
"Call me at this number," Lucas said. "Don't use my regular one. I worry about being tracked."
"As you should," Kidd said. "Give me an hour or two."
Lucas spent an hour putting together an email to Fort, explaining how he'd tracked Ritter, leaving out the part about stealing the bank statement. He saved the email to his laptop, but didn't send it. He went back to the bed, closed his eyes, and thought about the case. So far, he'd had nothing on Grant or Parrish. They were the ones he needed to get to. If he could nail Ritter for the murder of Whitehead, he could talk to the West Virginia cops about a prosecution. Looking at life in a West Virginia prison would be a powerful incentive to talk about Grant and Parrish. Of course, Ritter might be one of those hard-nosed stoics who'd take pride in not talking, who'd go to prison first. Kid called back. You said you already knew about Heracles. If you look at the company's incorporation papers, I'll send you a link, you'll find the list of officers. If you run the officers, you'll see that they're also the officers of two other companies, Flamma Consultants and Intercore Ballistic Products. Wait, there's a direct connection among Heracles, Flamma, and Intercore? Not technically direct, but yeah, they're all run by all the same people. Kid, this is serious shit. I'm throwing an extra $10 at the museum. Thanks, old buddy. Anyway, if you run Flamma Consultants, you'll find an online article published in last September's Combat Tech Review magazine called Can-Can Dancers. In the gun world, suppressors, silencers, are called cans. In that article, you find a picture of Ritter and a couple of other guys all geared up testing some big-bore silencers at a rifle range in Virginia, and Ritter is ID'd as an employee of Flamma. That's how you tied them together. Excellent, Lucas said. I owe you. Actually, you owe the museum $1,010. The original Flamma, by the way, was a famous Roman gladiator, which fits with the whole Heracles we read the classics thing. Oh, and let me encourage you to look at that magazine article. Ritter was testing that silencer on an M2010 sniper rifle, which is like a 300 Winchester Magnum and has an effective range of 1,200 meters. In other words, they can shoot you in the back from more than half a mile away. Thanks for the tip, Lucas said. I'll go hide under the bed. Listen, this Intercore Ballistics. I met this lawyer out here who told me an interesting story about a Pentagon bid. He told Kid what Gladys Ingram told him about a company that had outbid her client on a contract for lightweight side panel armor for military vehicles. Lucas was checking his notes as he described his meeting with Ingram. Her client was Malone Materials. If you could check around and see what happened with that particular lawsuit. I hate that kind of shit. Good guys die because of it, Kid said. Lucas knew Kid had served in an unusual military unit as a young man. I'll get back to you. I've got extensive resources at the Pentagon. You go hide under the bed. Rather than hiding under the bed, Lucas called up the text for the email to Fort, added the information about Flamma, which he supposedly found himself on the Internet, and sent it off. Grant and Parrish. Time to look at where they lived. He got his jacket and went back out, spent the afternoon cruising their houses, which weren't far apart, in Georgetown. Grant had a mansion, as was fitting for a billionaire, while Parrish lived in a townhouse. Lucas pulled out his iPad and entered Parrish's address. It popped up on Zillow, which showed it sold 3 years earlier for $1,450,000. 3 bedrooms, 3 baths. Close to M Street shopping. Not bad for a guy who'd never worked for anything other than the federal government and maybe 2 or 3 years at a private business, Lucas thought. It would be interesting to see if he had a mortgage, and, if so, how large it was. In the meantime, he drove over to M Street to see if that was a big deal, and it was, he supposed. It was like Madison Avenue meets Greenwich Village, mixing high-end clothing boutiques with burger joints, bars, and yuppie-oriented bicycle shops. He got a decent burger, drank a couple of Diet Cokes, watched the Washington women walking by, almost all of them clutching cell phones. He asked the waiter where he might buy a book.
The waiter had no idea, but a woman who overheard the question told him there was a used bookstore 3 blocks down the street. He spent a half hour browsing there, found a Carl Hiaasen hardcover novel, Skinny Dip, selling for $5.98, bought it, and took it back to the hotel. He'd left the burner phone in the closet safe, and when he checked it, he found a call from Kid that had come in 20 minutes earlier. He called back, and Kid said, "Okay, it's as bad as you thought. I've got some ways to check on information that most people wouldn't be able to use. The information is public and it's out there, so I worked backward through a lot of it." "I don't know what that means," Lucas said. "It means that after you find some information, after you know what you're looking for, you can usually find some other way to get to it. Something you could have at least theoretically gotten to. For example, if you know that a company did X, you can often find references to X as the 900th entry on a Google search. Nobody looks for it there. It would take forever. But if you know it's there and you've got specific search terms..." "Got it," Lucas said. "So what was 900th on the list?" "The guys who run Heracles and Flamma invented intercore ballistics after the army began looking for bidders on the armor panels. When they won the bid, they paid another company down in Florida, Bishop Composites, to make the armor. Intercore was the middleman on the deal. When I looked up Bishop, it turns out that their stuff had failed earlier tests for shrapnel resistance. They recycled their product through Intercore, and this time they passed the tests." "Was it different armor or the same?" "As far as I can tell, it appears to be identical." "Let me make that a little stronger. It was identical. After they failed the earlier tests, they were stuck with a lot of the plate, so they gave Intercore a cut-rate price. Bishop looks to have sold around $35 million in plate, and from looking at their financial statements, it appears that Intercore took about 20% of that." "20%? $7 million for doing nothing?" "Not for doing nothing. Intercore had to fix the deal." "Tell me how I get to that," Lucas said. Kid did, with explicit directions of where and how to search legally. Lucas understood most of what he found, although only a forensic accountant could pull it all together. He thought about it and called Gladys Ingram.
"Marshal Davenport," she said. "Nice to hear from you. How's the investigation going?"
"After you told me about your Malone Materials lawsuit, I went looking for information about intercore ballistics and found that it tied into my investigation."
"I'd like to pass some computer links to you. You probably have much better information resources than I do, so I thought you could take a look, and if you found anything interesting, you might pass it back to me."
"Sure. We still represent Malone, and I have an intern who was born with a silver computer in her mouth. What'd you find?"
Lucas gave her a few of Kid's key discoveries. She'd find the rest herself, or her intern would. Then, Lucas hoped, it would appear that the information was flowing from her to him rather than from him to her. When she had Lucas's notes, Ingram said,
"I'm impressed. I see why you made money on the Internet."
"Yeah, well, it isn't all that hard," Lucas said modestly. "If I had more time, I think I could probably find even more. Anyway, get back to me."
"I will.
And soon."
"Yes."
9. Parrish was led into Grant's house by a housekeeper who told him that Taryn Grant was in her study, the skiff in the basement. Grant was standing behind her desk, talking into a hardwired phone. She used a yellow pencil to point him at a chair. He sat, and while she talked to somebody about developing a new line of Samsung cell phone apps, it sounded crooked to Parrish, but what did he know? He considered lying to her about the attempt to mug Davenport, and decided against it. Grant was saying to someone, "Look, I don't want you to copy the code. I want you to look at what the code produces, and I want you to produce the identical fucking app with a different batch of code, and I want you to translate it into fucking Zulu. Are the fucking Zulus writing their own apps? Then find out. Call me back tomorrow. I want numbers." Grant was wearing a white blouse and an ankle-length white skirt, both with cutouts that looked like lace and offered peeks at what lay beneath. What lay beneath, Parrish thought, was either nothing at all or a body stocking that precisely matched her complexion. Either way, it wouldn't affect him much. Like Grant, he found power more compelling than sex. A quiet deal meeting at the Pentagon or the Senate office building, with serious people, was far more compelling than a piece of ass, anybody's ass. Grant put the phone on the hook and said to Parrish, "I mean, Jesus, how hard can it be?" "What are you trying to do?" She inspected him, rolling the yellow pencil between her fingers like a baton, and decided to take 10 seconds for the answer. "There are about 1 billion apps for the Samsung phone and the iPhone. The apps are mostly in the major languages, so you take the best ones and you redo the code so nobody can sue you for plagiarism, or whatever that would be, and put it into a non-English language that doesn't have that app, like Zulu. There are 10 million Zulu speakers, and I suspect about 80% of them have cell phones. 8 million phones times $2 for an app is worth doing, especially if you can translate the same app into a whole bunch of other non-major languages that add up to 1 billion people or so, and if developing the app costs you $10,000. Parrish considered this and finally said, "You know, I might have some people who'd be interested in talking to you about that, about specialized apps. I wonder if there are military apps, tactical apps. I wonder..." Grant waved him off. "No, no, no. The problem with that is you have to do research. Research costs money. The way we're doing it, we pay some nerd $5,000 to rewrite the app with different code and pay some college language professor another $2,000 to translate the language. No research. If it's already a popular app in 15 major languages, the market research is done, too." "I'll stick to guns," Parrish said. "Good idea." She'd been rocking from one foot to the other behind the desk, and now she stopped. "Speaking of which..." We missed him. We spotted him leaving the Watergate, but he grabbed a cab and took it all the way to a tailor shop where he stayed for almost 1.5 hours. Parrish said. "We set up to take him, but when he came out, he spotted us. And he ran. He was screaming for help. Jim told me it kind of freaked them out. He was supposed to be a fighter. We were all set for that."
"He ran?"
"Yes, hauled ass. Moore was coming up from one side, took a swing at him, but he blocked it and punched Moore in the face, and then he ran down the street screaming for help." The story made Grant smile, for a moment anyway, but then the smile vanished and she said, "That's 2 fuck-ups. Are you sure you got the right people? Do I have the right people?" "Yes, you do. Delta, SEALs, you couldn't get any better. They can take a guy down. But this... I told you he was smart. You need to spend some time looking him up on the internet," Grant said. "He's also violent, and somebody's going to get killed if you miss him again. I think it's time to reconsider." "Reconsider how?" Parrish asked. "Maybe we lay low, ignore him. If we see him following me around, we file a stalking complaint with the D.C. police and the Marshals Service based on his investigation back in Minnesota. Let him die on the vine." "Well, we could try that," Parrish said. "Still might be a good idea to keep an eye on him." "You can do that, but don't fuck it up. Stay back. If you lose him, let it go. Don't go running around like a bunch of idiots where he'll see you." They sat looking at each other across Grant's desk, and Parrish said, "Of course, there is the other problem." She nodded. "Smalls, Smalls, and Whitehead. If Davenport develops anything on that, we're talking about murder, the only way he could develop anything is to find the truck, which would get him to Jim, and Jim would get him to Flamma and Heracles, and from there to me, and then to you. If Smalls prepares the ground by going up to the Senate and tells people you tried to kill him and murdered his friend,
he'd have no proof, Grant said. Not a goddamn thing.
He doesn't need proof. He's not taking you to federal court. He's trying to undercut your possibilities. How many people have figured out that if you lie enough and loud enough, people will start to believe? Grant twiddled the pencil, muttered, "Goddamn that Davenport. I'll tell you something. He's not a bad-looking guy, and he's rich. I would have gone out with him if he'd asked, before all the trouble." "That's wonderful. Maybe you could say that on the floor of the Senate," Parrish said. "Watch your mouth," Grant snapped. She went back to twiddling. "Maybe laying low is the way to go. But if he looks like he's getting close to anything, we need to remove him, permanently or otherwise. Let me know before you move. I want the details." "If we kill him..."
Yeah, I know.
All the cops in the world will be after us, but not cops exactly like him. Other cops I can handle. He's the one I'm not sure about." "He's your basic operator. He's Jim Ritter," Parrish said. "But smarter. God damn it, Parrish, he's got me worried. And I've got other things to worry about. We'll handle him, one way or another." When Parrish was gone, Grant wandered around the skiff. The room had unadorned polished concrete walls, floor, and ceiling, designed to make any alterations instantly visible. All the wiring for power and communications came through the ceiling in a single stainless steel tube that ran through a safe-like steel compartment on the first floor. If somebody wished to bug her, they would have to do it by first eluding one of the best security systems ever built, and then getting into either the first floor steel safe or through the steel basement door, all without making a mark. She'd been told that was, essentially, impossible with current technology. The only way to get at her would be through a computer bug introduced into the dual computer systems by a visitor. Both computers also carried software designed to detect any attempts to do that. The secure computer accepted only encrypted messages, preceded by recognized keystrokes, and transmitted only encrypted messages. The other computer, which was isolated from the first, was considered non-secure and was used for routine communications only. Both computers had isolation capabilities. Everything coming and going was captured in a software box where Grant could check it before it was released to the rest of the computer. Anything not recognized would be burned. She was still paranoid enough that she rarely used the computers and was careful to shut them down and kill the power when not in use. A minute's delay in powering them up was worth the security that step brought. She found the uninflected gray concrete environment of the skiff surprisingly conducive to thought. She thought about Davenport, about Parrish, about George Claxon and the Heracles operators, and about the presidency. Parrish and Claxon assured her that the operators didn't know her name, didn't know who they were indirectly working for. She didn't believe that. If they couldn't figure it out, Parrish, after all, was her paid aide, they were too dumb to be working for her. Knowing or suspecting was okay, though, as long as they had no proof. Davenport's investigation could probably be derailed by one simple action. She could fire Parrish, call it all off, wait for 6 or 10 years to run for president. The cable news shows loved her. She was hot, sassy, well-briefed, always prepared with a few quips about whatever the subject matter was, always willing to treat the producers and the talking heads as if they were actual movers and shakers, which they loved more than anything. She could go on her pick of cable shows and let drop that her only current political interest was serving the people of Minnesota, and no, she wouldn't be a candidate for the presidency. Not now, anyway. Getting rid of Parrish, her connection with Claxon and Heracles, and announcing that she wouldn't run for the presidency, removed all her motives for attacking Smalls or anyone else. She thought about that for a while. Thought about how the newsies clamored after even the possibility of getting video of the president walking between the White House and his helicopter. About how they chased him around a golf course. About cameramen taking video of his friggin' airplane taking off. Because, you know, the president is in there. That was more than celebrity. They treated the president like Caesar, like Stalin, like God. And that's what she wanted. She could feel it, taste it, to be the most important looked-at person on the planet. She was young enough. She could wait. But she didn't want to. 10. After finishing the report, Lucas watched television for a while, and a few minutes after 9 o'clock, there was another knock at a door, and this time it was his door. He removed the spitball from the peephole, checked, and saw Ray peering in at him. Man! Lucas was pleased to see her, and him. Ray Givens, the tall, thin black woman, a former basketball player at the University of Connecticut, and her partner, Bob Matisse, the short, wide, former wrestler. Ray was wearing a red pantsuit that was loose enough to hide the Glock bump at her hip. Bob was wearing a blue cotton jacket over a knit golf shirt, and similar hip bump, and khakis. They were apparently happy enough to see him as well. Ray giving him a hug, Bob slapping him on the back, and Lucas, once he got the door shut, began cross-examining Bob about his leg wounds. All healed up. Still get some pain now and then, and they tell me that'll probably go on for a while, maybe forever, Bob said. But it doesn't slow me down at all. He did a couple of squats to prove it. Not that he was all that lightning fast to begin with, Ray said. Our rooms are down the hall, Bob said, marveling. Boy, oh boy, the Watergate. Do we get one of those mini-bars? Possibly, Lucas said, laughing. In addition to personal duffel bags, they each were carrying a heavy tan canvas duffel stuffed with black rifles, ammo, armor, helmets, and everything else you needed to break down doors and bust gun-crazed fugitives. Tell us everything. Ray said, dropping onto the bed. Lucas told them about Parrish and Grant, about Heracles and Flamma, about finding the Ford F-250, about the street attack, about checking out Parrish's and Grant's houses. Pulling full-time surveillance on them would be difficult. They've got these former military operators hanging around, and there's no good place to set up. He pulled up the addresses on Google Earth so they could check out the streets. It's all choked up. There's no place to watch from where you don't stand out like a sore thumb. They talked about that for a while, and Bob said, You know, I don't think we'll find out much by trailing them around, Grant and Parrish. We need people we can talk to, voluntarily or otherwise. Might be better to figure out who knows about the bad stuff, might be willing to deal and pick them up and squeeze them. Lucas considered that and nodded. You've got a point. They already know I'm poking around, but they don't know that I spotted the truck. As far as we know, Ray said. Yeah, as far as we know. They might have been in my room, they sure as hell know I was in that tailor shop, but I never felt them watching me. Lucas walked around, scratched his head, and said, Everything is up in the air. I'm almost certain that Parrish was involved in trying to kill Smalls, but that doesn't mean that Grant was. Parrish might have wanted to kill Smalls for his own reasons. He wants to ride Grant's coattails as a senator and maybe someday as president. Did she know what was going to happen? If she did, she's guilty of murder. You told us that she's already guilty of murder, back in Minneapolis. She is, but I couldn't prove it, Lucas said.